Just a quick disclaimer before we start this episode. We weren't able to achieve the typical audio quality that we'd like to achieve with our episodes. I think you'll find that this is listenable, but just wanted to give you a heads up. Cue Mr. Crosby.
Four.
Straight down the middle. It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook. Just
so let's talk about win number one, which I believe came at the Houston Coca-Cola Open at Woodlands Country Club in 1984.
That is correct. Your first win on tour is obviously pretty special. Buddy Gardner finished second to me there. I ended up winning by two. I still like going down to the Woodlands. Yeah, we have a champions event down there. I'm sure, as Bruce knows, I believe somebody may have designed that golf course,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I wonder who that was.
Is that right? Did you do that one, partner?
The TPC, the TPC course.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't win on that course, but actually the next year we played that golf course in 1985. I think they figured since I won there that, it's producing bad champions, so they need to move it to a different golf course. So
I don't think that's true, but.
But it's funny the things that you remember. I played the first two rounds there with Gary McCord and Buddy Gardner, right? Two kind of somewhat different guys, right?
Yeah.
Certainly Gary is. We all know that.
Right.
But I remember playing.
I can't remember if it was the first or second round, but Buddy went in to use the bathroom, right? You know, the Portageon. And Gary turned to me and he goes, "Watch this." And he took a golf ball and threw it at the Portageon while Buddy was in there doing whatever he was doing.
Oh,
right?
Dear.
And it, those things
make a hell of a noise.
It made so much noise, right? And, Buddy sticks his head out the door and his eyes are this big. And I'm like, so this is the PGA Tour, huh? This is what it's like out here.
Oh, real serious.
And it was kind of funny.
Buddy ended up finishing second. And I think Gary played really well, too. I think he may have been in the top five as well. But, I remember being paired with them, and I played with John Mahaffey the last round there too, who was, he lived in the Woodlands.
Houston boy.
So he was, the crowd favorite, and we're playing the last round together, and, I beat the crowd favorite. So they probably, everybody was mad at me for beating them, but it was special. That first win is tough to come by, and sometimes the second one's harder, but the first one was fantastic. The Tournament of Champions was the next week back then.
Hmm.
So I had to change my plans and go play in that, which is a good way to, good reason to change plans for sure.
I would say so. Yeah.
By the time you started, Corey, I don't recall exactly when this changed. Was it top 125 or was it still the lower number and you had to qualify every week if you didn't make the cut?
No, I was a top 125 guy. So the
change, I believe,
was for the 1983 season. It was the first year that they did a top 125. So I just missed the Monday qualifying category, which I can't imagine how hard that is to do that. That system was very difficult, that it's hard to, play freely and go for things. So it was a bit advantage for the veterans, but I think we've seen a change and there's more turnover now than there was back in that other system.
Bruce, you can relate to that pressure back then under that system because you played under that system, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I was very lucky though. I got a couple of exemptions early on in the piece, and then I sort of went broke on my first five invites to play, and then the next year when I come back in 64, I won my first tournament at St. Pete. So then, like Corey said, your life changes drastically in 1 week.
It does, yeah. Did that lock you in for 2 years? Is that what that was?
No, it was. It was only 1 year then. Only one year.
It was 1 year?
Yeah, yeah. And the guy that you played with in Houston was the loudest voice for the change to go to 125.
Yes,
it was Gary McCord.
Gary.
Yeah. He's the one that sort of drove that vehicle to make the change from 60 to 125.
And I think it was a good
I thought it was a good
change, actually, you know, looking back on it, I think. Anyway, everybody has their opinion. Yeah.
Let's move along to the following year, and this is a tournament Bruce is familiar with as well, Colonial National Invitational. This was your first of a couple of victories there, I think, by four over Bob Murphy.
Yeah, the Murph. Yeah, that tournament, I just say it outright, that's my favorite tournament on tour. I'm sure some of the reason is that I've had a lot of success there, but I remember when I first played there, I just loved the golf course. I just thought it was a golf course built for me, for a player like me. And obviously Hogan, you know, it's Hogan's Alley, it's his place. And, you know, he's the only one, I mean, he's won five times there. He won five times there. And I just loved it from the get-go. You know, the hospitality there is amazing. It was kind of the first tournament on tour that had the family hospitality.
Yes, it, you know, it
they had, you know, dinners.
And yeah, they had every meal that we wanted there. You know, breakfast, lunch, dinner. They had the first, I'm sure it was the first. Yeah, babysitting, yeah, a nursery, whatever you want to call it. They had that there. I mean, it was an incredibly well-run tournament and really catered to us. I mean, they spoiled us rotten.
Yes, sir.
And everybody loves to be spoiled rotten.
Yeah.
As long as you know you're being spoiled, it's okay. But yeah. So I love the tournament from the get-go, and I think it's just a fantastic golf course. And you know, having, you know, I won there, I think I might have, I'm not sure if I was the youngest to win at that time. I think Stockton had won. He was, I don't know if I beat his record or I was second, but, you know, I was fairly young to have won that tournament. And
heck of a
and
score.
I played so well that week. I mean, I just
couldn't play much better.
And at that time, that was one of the biggest events on the PGA Tour. So it was a huge win for me. It meant a lot. And, you know, maybe it got other people's attention, you know, some peers' attention, but I can't think of a better place to win than there. And I was pretty fortunate to do it again. And I've had a couple second place finishes there too. I lost a playoff to Bruce Litsky one year there as well. So it's a course that suits my game and it suits my eye. And I wish every tournament was there. I'd say every week there would be great.
Well, 14 under, that year, 1985, I think you set a scoring record with that performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was at that time. It's since been beaten, but yeah, I think it beat by, I beat it by a couple. I think Trevino may have had the record before that, I believe, but it's always nice to beat records, but records are always going to get beat, or it seems like they will. So I knew it would be short lived, but at least it was living. For a little
Bruce,
bit.
I don't know what it is about the Colonial, but we've talked to 12 winners of the Colonial over our time doing the podcast so far.
Well, now, Mike, you know, we've talked to a lot of very, very good players. I mean,
well, there is a bit of a correlation between Colonial and U.S. Opens as well. I think
you're right. Yeah,
there's something to be said for that. There is some history there, or at least with major wins. But I think there is a closer connection to U.S. Opens, I believe.
Yeah. And then next year they're going to change the golf course again.
Yeah, I heard they're going to redo it. I'm not sure they're going to change too much, but yeah, I heard, you know, the par three. I think 13. I think they may restore to the way it was before my time. I'm not sure what it was when you played. Bruce, was it over the water like that?
No, not originally it was.
Yeah, it was off to the right and behind the 12th green, right? The tee, and you hit along the water kind of?
Yeah, the most difficult hole there in the early days was actually the eighth hole, the par three. It used to sit up in the air right on the Trinity Bank there, and it was, I mean, it was a brutal par three, and then, of course, they changed all that.
Yeah. I think when the river overflowed and, you know, flooded the whole area, I think they made some changes there.
Yeah, yeah, that's what made the change. I think the fact that it used to flood.
Yeah, it's a wonderful golf course. I'd recommend it to anybody to go out there and play there.
Let's jump ahead to 1986. The first of your Hawaiian Open wins came at Wailea Country Club by two over Paul Azinger.
Yep, Yep. I love playing in Hawaii too. I've had a lot of success over in Hawaii. The probably the greatest thing about the tournament back then is that United Airlines was sponsoring it, and it was the best perk of a win that you get. And it was free first class travel for yourself and your immediate family for a year.
Pretty nice.
It was a nice perk, really nice perk. And I liked that perk so much, I decided to win it again the next year. So I had two straight years of free first class flights on United.
Yeah, can't beat
it's that. A good deal.
Yeah, you can kind of get used to that, can't you?
Yeah, maybe too used to it, actually.
Yeah. Well, same year that you got your first win at Hawaii, you then came to Milwaukee and won the Greater Milwaukee Open in 1986 at Tuckaway Country Club, and that came in a playoff with Dave Barr.
Yeah. It was four-hole playoff, maybe,
yeah,
I think.
Four holes. Yeah.
The neat thing, what I remember liking about that win the most, it was the first time I won multiple tournaments in a year. So, it's
certainly not easy
to win one, but it sure seems
very hard to win two.
And I was really pleased that I had won two tournaments in a single calendar year on the PGA Tour. I was very, very proud of that second win there. To get two in a calendar year, it meant a lot to me.
And then next year you did the same thing. Two again.
I did. I liked it. I liked it so much. I did it again.
Yeah, why not?
And I think I was trying for more because I got those two wins, before the West Coast ended. I had those wins before March 1st hit. So I really wanted to win more than two, and it didn't happen. And I never have, actually, on the PGA Tour. But it was nice to win Hawaii again and win the Hope.
It was a pretty good start to the year,
that's for sure.
You had a habit of beating a lot of very, very good players, too. You beat Langer at the Hope, and then you beat Stadler in Hawaii.
Yeah. It's more fun for me to play against, great players.
Great players.
Good players. I think anybody who loves to compete enjoys the challenge of beating somebody who's really good. Whether it's, any sport you're playing, whether it's a team sport, an individual sport, it means a lot to me to beat players that are, that have a excellent record.
So that birdie putt at the last at the Hope, I didn't know what your position was at the time. Did you know that was for the win when you made it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were actually, Bernhard and I were playing together the last round.
Group?
And we're pretty good friends, and we were very, very good friends then as well. And we were actually tied playing the last hole. It's the last hole. There's a dogleg left, and there's water all down the left side. So I got up there and aimed at the water and hit a cut right off the water back into the fairway, which a lot of people go, "Oh, my gosh, I can't believe you did that." And I went, there was no way I was going to hit a left. It just wasn't going to happen. That was my shot. The hard shot was my second shot. I hit a 4-iron and drew it into the pin with water left. That was a very good shot I hit there.
Yeah.
And Bernhard ended up with about a 5-6 footer for par, and I had maybe about a 22-3 footer for birdie, and I just knocked it right in. You don't get putts to win a tournament very often, and when you do get it and you make it, it's unique. It just doesn't happen much. You win tournaments, but you might win by one or two, and maybe you par the last hole and you tap it in. But to make a putt to win, that was really cool. I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bernhard was fantastic. He was, if you ever watch the tape of it, I knock it in and they kind of cut to Bernhard, and he's just got this huge grin on his face. He's just an amazing guy, right?
Yeah.
He was just like smiling like, wow, that was amazing, So
what a player.
It was fun.
What a player. Oh, man, what a great player he's been.
Well, win number two in 1987, as you mentioned, was the back-to-back at Wailea. So that came in a playoff with Craig Stadler.
Yeah. Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a 2 on a par 5 to win a 2-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me. 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
Yep. I was very fortunate there because I'd finished earlier in the day, so to speak. I played a really good last round, and Stads had about a, I don't know, it wasn't a long putt on the last hole for birdie to win, and he missed it. So I got in the playoff, and I think there was the second playoff hole. I made another nice putt to win there. It wasn't to win actually when I made it, but I made about a 25 footer, and he had, you know, maybe about a 12, 15 footer to tie and go an extra hole in the playoff, and he missed it, and I won. So, again, a nice putt. You know, I made a nice putt in a clutch situation. And when you win playoffs, they're fun. When you lose them, it's not as much fun.
Yeah, ask Ben Crenshaw.
Yeah, he's Ofer, isn't he?
Yeah, he was an Ofer.
Yeah, he was real good about that when we talked to him about it. But you'd rather those be 8-0 instead of 0-8.
Oh, is that what it was? 0-8? Yeah.
That's not fun.
So moving on, you win another tournament down in Texas, this time the following year, 1988, in the Texas Open at Oak Hills Country Club. That must have been a leisurely walk up that final fairway with the lead you had.
Yeah, it was, that's for sure. You know, the lead into that tournament was interesting. From kind of the after a great start in 87, I actually did not play that well until the Texas Open. I had, you know, it was, I'd say that win was in the middle of a slump, actually. I wasn't playing well. It was a pretty bad year, actually. And I remember calling up Bruce, you know, the other Bruce, not you, right, but Bruce Hamilton, my teacher. And he flew out to the Texas Open there. And we worked for a couple days and he flew home. And I felt a lot better after he left. And I just played so well. It was like everything just clicked. It was really amazing. I don't even remember missing a shot. I made a lot of putts. You know, I don't even know how much I ended up winning by. Was it
8?
I was going to say 7. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, it was 8.
And, you know, the funny thing, you say leisurely walk on the last hole. I did not relax or felt kind of at ease until I teed off on 17. That's when after I hit that tee shot, I was like, I think I got this now, you know?
Yeah.
And I had an 8-shot lead or whatever it was at the time. So, you know, it's, you know, I never really let my guard down until the very end. And I did enjoy the last 2 holes.
Bet.
So it's nice to win by that many. It doesn't happen often. I've had a couple opportunities like that, but, I'm not a overpowering player. I can't just destroy golf courses. When everything's on, I can do well, but yeah, it doesn't happen that often. And, you know, the guys that are strong, long hitters and, you know, beat up the par fives and, you know, hit long drives and flips into par fours, you know, they can beat up a golf course and win by a lot. I've never fit into that category of long knocking, overpowering guy. So it was fun.
After the 88 season there, you sort of got lost there for a while in 89 and 90 and didn't sort of win a tournament after, you know, after winning 5 in 3 years. You had to be feeling a little tough.
It was, you know, from kind of the middle of 87 or maybe even earlier through the middle of 90. It was very trying times for my patience certainly for my confidence. Like I said, 88 was like an anomaly. I just out of nowhere, I won, but then I went right back to playing poorly. And you know, the big change for me, in 1990 It came at the Byron Nelson. I
was watching,
I think it was on ESPN, they had a special about Payne Stewart. And Payne Stewart was working with this guy named Dr. Richard Koop. And, you know, as a sports psychologist, and turned Payne's game around. You know, Payne was constantly in the hunt, but never could finish it off and was messing up. And then all of a sudden, Payne started playing well and winning tournaments. And Dr. Koop was in the forefront of that change. So I was thinking, well, you know, if it worked for Payne, you know, it's got to be a piece of cake for me, right? So I actually had a meeting with Dr. Koop, set it up at the Byron Nelson. Of course, I missed the cut, and I'm depressed, and I'm just in the biggest funk of my career, right? Payne wins the tournament, and
Dr. Koop's there,
and he goes to Payne's press conference. Everybody's happy, and everything's great. And I'm staying at the Four Seasons there at the hotel right at the golf course. And after Dr. Koop's done there, he comes up to my room, and he walks into my room, and, you know, it's
5 o'clock in the afternoon,
6 o'clock, you know, the sun's up, and I have the curtains drawn. I mean, and the room's pitch dark, you know, just like you'd expect someone who doesn't feel really good about themselves. And he went from celebration to, you know, the top to the bottom. And we had a very long conversation, and we talked and did some work, I think the next day. And I remember the next week was Memorial. They'd actually split up, the Nelson and Colonial. We went to Memorial. I worked on the stuff, you know, that we were working on, and
played better.
You know, basically what I'd got into this horrible habit of
looking up. Yeah, Bruce, you know this.
Everybody knows this, right? Every golfer can relate to this. You get a shot, you look up, and instead of looking at the green or the pin, you see the bunker, you see the water, you see the trees. You just don't focus on where you want to hit it. Yeah. You're just focused on where you don't want to hit it. And I'd gotten into that habit, really, you know, a very bad habit. And Dr. Koop said, all right, this is what we're going to do.
You're going to pick a spot in front of your ball.
Kind of like what Nicklaus does.
Right.
You know, whatever. It could be 2 yards in front. It could be 5 yards, whatever. And there's no trouble between, you know, that spot and your ball, right? So, I mean, I didn't even have to look up, right? So, you know, I could just get over the shot, look at my spot, look back at my ball, look at my spot, look back at my ball, and hit. Because I'd lined up that spot to where I wanted to hit my shot. So that's what we did. And so I never had that visual of looking at anything bad. Right. And I just concentrated on the process of hitting the shot I was trying to hit. And because of where my spot was, that was where I was aiming. So I never had to look up, and it changed everything for me at that point. And I remember at the end of the year, I was playing in Las Vegas. I think it was the second to the last tournament. I think I qualified for the Tour Championship by shooting 64-3 the last round at Las Vegas. And I remember I was at the airport. This is how long ago it was. I got on a payphone. There was no cell phones back then. And I got on a payphone, and I called Dr. Koop, and I said, Dick, I've got it. I'm going to have a great year next year. I know it.
And next year was 91. And, you know, I won the money title. And
as you said, you know, player of the year too. So I owe a lot to Dick Koop. He turned my game around in weeks, actually.
For those listening to this podcast, they'll also come away from the fact that you had a habit of winning at the same location a couple of times. Of course, you went right back in 91, won at the Bob Hope Classic again.
Yep. Yeah, there's certain places I guess I liked. Yeah, I won at the Hope. Again, those are good courses for me. They're kind of short, tight, require more accuracy than power. It was a heck of a tournament. I played so well there, and I'm trying to remember what we. I went in a playoff over over Mark O'Meara,
right?
And I think we were both 30
under, I believe,
when we finished the 90 holes, which is a
big.
Yeah, I would never think I was capable of that kind of a clip, you know, averaging birding one out of every three holes.
Yeah.
And we tied, and Tim Simpson was one shot back. So, you know, those courses can get ripped up, you know, back then. We went in a playoff, and another fortunate thing for me, I chipped in on the first hole to beat Mark. And, you know, Mark and I have known each other, gosh, since
I guess college.
We might have known each other before that. We played a lot of college golf against each other. So he said later, he wasn't very surprised that I chipped in, but but I was glad I did. So that was a nice win there too. That was fun.
Yeah, we had Mark on the show just a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact, and I don't remember if this came up or not. We probably didn't bring it up.
I almost made a hole in one on 15, I think it was. I hit it up there. It was actually, the ball was in the air, and I said, "Go in, go in." And it rolled up about like that far short of the hole.
Oh boy.
I'm sure that probably made Mark go,
what's up with this guy?
Well, let's continue on with your player of the year, which was 1991. You went down to Atlanta, won the Bell South Golf Classic at Atlanta Country Club, and this time again in a playoff with Steve Pate.
Yeah, my teammate. You know, we played golf together at UCLA. That was one long day. The old Atlanta Country Club, very hilly golf course. Saturday it poured down rain, and I think I was on the third green when the heavens opened up. And so we came back Sunday morning, so I had to play whatever that is, you know, 33 holes. And you know, Steve had to play a lot of holes too. And at the end of that, we were tied, so we had to go play more holes. And on the second playoff hole, I managed to get the better of Steve. Yeah, I think he pulled his shot into a bunker and it buried, and he was dead where he hit it on the par three. But it was nice. It was a nice win. It was, again, a playoff. You know, playoffs are so pressure packed. It's the same thing as playing the last hole tied, you know, so it's, just mano a mano, or unless there's more, unless it's three guys or four guys. But I enjoy playoffs. I like that head to head stuff.
You were pretty good at it.
Well, it's fun. maybe we're right back where we started. It's fun because I've done okay in it. You know, I just love match play. I love that head to head stuff.
Well, speaking of playoffs, Bruce, you came close here 22 years before.
I did. Yes, I did. I tied Bert Yancey. Bert Yancey beat me on the 16th hole.
I bet you're still mad.
No, I'm not too mad. No. I was then, though.
Oh, of course. Why wouldn't you be?
Yeah, I was not happy then. Anyhow.
He was a heck of a player, wasn't he?
Yancey. He was a – it's funny because when my wife and I moved over to the United States, we had an arrangement with a golf club in Florida, and Bert and Linda Yancey lived in a little villa right next to where we lived at the same club. So,
okay.
Yeah, we knew one another very well, but I still wasn't happy with him.
Well, there's nothing better than beating a friend, is there?
Well, let's move on to the 1992 Honda Classic at Weston Hills Golf and Country Club. Once again, in a playoff with Mr. Couples.
Yep. That was an interesting tournament. There's a lot of stuff that happened in that tournament.
There sure was.
I remember I think I double bogeyed 16. And I thought, oh, there goes the tournament. I'm out of it. 17 was super hard par three. I think I parted, I believe. But I still thought I was done. You know, I was, I don't know, maybe two or three groups in front of Freddie. And I got on 18, par five, three-shot par five, and decided to hit an iron for my third shot and slam dunked it right into the hole for eagle. It just flew in and stayed right there. And I was playing with Raymond Floyd, and he was excited that I made it. But I still didn't think I had a chance to win. You know, it didn't even dawn on me. And I'd finished the hole, you know, and kind of looked at the board, and I was like, oh, you know, I'm I think I had a one shot lead actually after that. I think Freddie had probably messed up somewhere back there, and Freddie got up to 18 and hit a wedge or whatever he hit in there, and he almost holed it. It ended up like a, you know, a tap in, you know, 2 inches. So we went into a playoff, and it was getting pretty late. We played 10, we tied on 10, and then we played 18 again. And he had maybe a 25 footer for birdie, and he just missed. And I had about a 20 footer for birdie, and it was pretty dark. And it was definitely the last hole. You know, if we tied that hole, we were spending the night there. So there was some more impetus to make it. And I knocked it right in the middle, and, you know, Freddie in his old, you know, his nonchalant way, it was like, he was just sort of watching it out of the corner of his eye and went in, and he just kind of like, whatever, you know. And but it was one of my better putts again. A putt to win is always fun. And at least I got to drive home that night. I lived in Orlando at the time, so I just drove up home. And I remember getting home, and my son Ryan, so that was 92, so he was five or six at the time, and he was there meeting me at the door when I pulled in at like 11 at night, because, you know, it was a 3-hour drive or so. And he was so excited. And we watched the tape. Eric and I drove up, my caddy. We drove up together, got to the house, and we all sat around and watched the VHS tape of the tournament again, another old which was term. Fun.
Yeah,
it was fun to relive it right away.
Yeah, and you and Freddie's had a bit of a rivalry in 92, didn't you?
Yeah, we've had some events where we've competed against each other over the years.
I mean, but he had, I think at this tournament, he had just been selected if I'm not mistaken, had he already been selected the player of the year by you, maybe by
91. Yeah. Well, he was in 91. He was the PGA Tour player of the year.
Yeah. Okay.
And in 91, okay. I was PGA of America player of the year.
Yeah. Okay. And I think it was just by one vote over you too, for that.
It was by one vote. And, you know, next time I'm voting for me and not him.
The truth comes out here finally after all these years, huh? Oh, well.
93 was a blanket year for you two. No wins in 93. And then you got a little bit of revenge on Mr. Couples again, right?
94, yeah. Yeah, 94. Open? Yeah. I'm going to revisit 93 a little bit.
Okay.
You know, I didn't win on the tour, on the PGA Tour, but I won the World Match Play that year over at Wentworth. And to this day, in my own mind, that was one of the most satisfying wins I've ever had. You know, as you know, it's match play. You play 36-hole matches.
36.
My first match was against Peter Baker, who had beat me in the singles in the Ryder Cup maybe the month before. So that was nice to get a little revenge for that.
Yeah. That was just the start of it, though.
Yeah, that was the start. That was like the smallest one. My next match was Nick Price, who was
number one or two in the
world at the time. And I beat him 2-1 or 3-2 or whatever it was. My next match was against Colin Montgomery,
who was very highly
ranked at the time as well. Obviously, I beat him in 37 holes. And then the finals was against Nick Faldo, who was...
He might have been number one.
Or he was right there, too. So, and I beat him on the 36th hole. I won that one up. So the people I went through to win that tournament...
was pretty special.
No wonder you felt great.
I felt really good
about it. And I played a lot of golf. That's a beast of a tournament back then. You know, they don't play the same format anymore, but 4 36-hole matches in a row at Wentworth, which is a pretty long course for me then. And it was really cold, too. I was wearing a stocking cap the whole time. It was a very cold week, and I'm not a big fan of cold weather, so to do that well in cold weather was nice as well. So that was a win I was very, very pleased with.
Yeah, always a great field. They took good care of you, too. Were they still chauffeuring you around in Rolls Royces back then?
Well, I don't know if it was Rolls Royces, but you know, they put us up in houses. You know, there was, I guess then there were 12 players, I believe, in the tournament. Four players had a bye, and I did not. So it was 12 in the match play. But they put us in these beautiful houses. They had a cook for us. So every night we just ordered dinner, and they'd make it, whoever was there cooking for us. And they had a car service. You know, there was always someone driving us around if we wanted to go around. It was a pretty special tournament.
Yeah. Anything else you wanted to mention about 1993?
No. Nothing else I can remember. I just remember that tournament.
Well, I don't blame you for remembering
it. Was nice.
That.
I think I played okay in 93. I just didn't win. That's all.
Now you go to Riviera and win by two over Fred Couples, as Bruce was beginning to mention.
Yeah, Riviera, another one of my favorite golf courses. I love the golf course. I like the small, well, they used to be smaller greens, but I like small greens, and accuracy is very important at Riviera. But it was a nice win. Yeah, it's always nice to beat a guy like Freddie. He's tough. You know, everybody looks at him and sees this, you know, happy-go-lucky guy. But, you know, underneath all that, he's a tremendous competitor. And he wants to win as bad as anybody else, even though it doesn't appear that way sometimes. But so it's nice. It's nice to beat a guy like that.
And you came right back and won it again the following year, didn't you?
I did. Yeah, back to backers there. Again, you know, it's a great golf course to win on. You know, to you know, for me and every golfer, every professional golfer, it's great to win. But when you win on a wonderful golf course, it means more. And be able to win there back to back, kind of in my backyard. I didn't really grow up there, but you know, I grew up 50 miles north, and I really never played Riviera, even when I was at UCLA, which is only a few miles away. I think I was only on the golf course twice before I played on the PGA Tour. Well, I played twice as an amateur there in the tournament, but other than that, I was only on the golf course twice, besides you know, the Los Angeles Open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that second time you won by three over J. Don Blake and Kenny Perry. I think Kenny had won the Hope the week before, and you were one back to him after 54 holes. But that was the first back-to-back win there since Mr. Palmer did it back in the 60s.
Yeah, I remember hearing something about that when I did it. But did. Yeah, it's been done since then, but it had been a big gap. Yeah, anytime, you know, you're in the same sentence as Arnold Palmer, that's a good thing.
Yeah. And then, Steve Elkington, who, by the way, turns 59 years old today. He's the birthday boy. He won there in the PGA later that year, didn't he?
He did. You know, I remember going into that PGA feeling pretty good. You know, I was certainly one of the favorites going in there. And I felt so good about myself, I decided that I would just miss the cut and not make it to the weekend. So sometimes expectations are difficult to deal with. And I just played poorly there. And, you know, it was a tough week. Very disappointing for me. You know, obviously, Steve was very happy. Colin was not happy. Montgomery, he lost a playoff to Steve. But, yeah, it was a disappointing week for that regard, because I've had a lot of good tournaments at Riviera, and you know, it happens. You know, I've missed the cut at Colonial too. Actually, the year I won the U.S. Open, I missed the cut at Colonial, which was a very strange thing, but it did happen.
Yeah, you look at Mark O'Meara's success at Pebble Beach. You almost expected him to win a U.S. Open there.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, what, did he win five times there, or six times? I don't know what it was. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Colonial number two, 1996, by two over Mr. Sluman.
Yeah, little Jeffrey. He was my assistant captain in the Ryder Cup in 2010. Yeah. I won in 85, and I lost a playoff, I think, maybe it was 1990, and I finished second. Or maybe, no, I'm sorry, maybe it was 91 I lost a playoff. In 90, I finished second to Nick Price there. So I was close a couple times, and you know, it, there's nobody that's won Colonial more than two times, except Mr. Hogan. Right. He's won it five. So to get that second win there and to be in a pretty select group of guys was special as well. Yeah, I remember playing the last hole. I had a one shot lead and, you know, hit a nice drive right down the middle and knocked my shot kind of in the middle of the green, like you're supposed to. And I had one shot lead and 20 foot uphill putt. And, you know, I made it, to kind of cap it off. It was a nice way to finish off the tournament, you know, making a birdie on the last hole.
Yeah.
But you know, Colonial again, it's just one of my favorite places to play and to get another win there, you know, another kind of feather in the cap, I guess. But it's again, favorite place. I love it.
Bruce, we got one more regular tour win to talk about.
Yeah, that came quite an extended period after the after the previous one. 10 years later, Corey.
Yeah, more than a decade later.
Isn't that amazing? Tell us about that.
Yeah.
You did create a very significant scoring record at Brown Deer Park, right?
Yep.
46 years old, and you shoot 26 on the way to a 61. That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it's a good way to open a tournament, isn't it?
You know, boy.
You know, the lead up, the 10-year period after I won Colonial was rough. It was a slump of all slumps. You know, the one I had, you know, from middle of 87 to the middle of 90 was a miniature slump compared to this one. So this one was brutal. Many times I was thinking, you know, maybe I should just quit, do something else. You know, missed a lot of cuts, just had some really bad years. Thank God I'd won the U.S. Open because at that time it gave me a 10-year exemption on tour.
Right.
So I was able to use that. But I would not have qualified multiple years under the system if I hadn't had that exemption. It was a rough time, a time I had to really work hard to try to figure out how to get my game back. And so that's why that win there meant so much to me. It was a long battle, you know, demons and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It was tough to start that tournament off like that. About as good a start as you can have, pretty much. You know, I birdied 8 of the first 9 holes. I didn't realize at the time it was a 26. Eric knew it because Eric knows stuff like that. He just gets it. I didn't realize it was a par 34. I was thinking more, you know, I was 8 under and I had a shot to break 60. I was thinking more on those lines. And I had to eagle the last hole to do so. And I kind of went for it and ended up, it was a par 5. And I took a big chance and I ended up with about a 5-footer for par, which I made. And so afterwards, I went in the press room and they told me it was a 26. And I went, what? What are you talking about? I didn't even know. And I kind of, when they said it, I thought, that sounds like a record, right? You know, I'd heard of guys shooting 27. You know, I knew there was a lot of guys that did that, but I didn't know that 26 had been shot ever. And so it's still a standalone record. Nobody's ever done it since. You know, the joke that Eric and I have about it is that the 7th hole is a par 3, and it's the only hole I didn't birdie on the front 9. And I can't remember the yardage exactly, but he wanted me to hit a 5-iron. And the pin was in the front and I didn't like it. So I hit a 4-iron and I hit it about 30 feet past the hole. So a 5-iron would have been perfect. And I 2-putted and made par. And he goes, well, if you would have listened to me,
yeah,
you know, you would have birdied every hole on the front 9. So that's kind of our little joke that we have amongst the two of us. But now everybody knows. But it was fun. It was nice to win there after 10 years of struggling, wondering if I'd ever even play well again, let alone win again. At the age of 46, it was very cool to win there. And it was actually, you know, my wife, Lisa, it was the first time she ever saw me win. So she was there and I just kind of, I'm going to lose it now, but I lost it then. And when she came out and we hugged, and I remember David Faraday was trying to get an interview with me, and I just pushed him away because I just wanted to hug Lisa. So, yeah. And David just like turned to the camera and goes, "Oh, well, I guess I'm not going to interview him." And then they just went up to the top. So, back to the booth, but, I just pushed him away because I was not interested in David. I was interested in Lisa.
And that win came 20 years after your first win in Milwaukee. Of course, that tournament 20 years later was sponsored by U.S. Bank, who had the sponsorship for a few years. You also tied the 36-hole scoring record with 125, so that's a pretty good start. I know the 26 beat a few guys. One of the 27s I remember is Andy North, a Wisconsinite, who did it at the BC Open, as I remember, Bruce.
Yes, I think so. That's right.
Yeah, I saw Andy the next day, actually, and he had a few words to say to me about it. Yeah, all in jest, but he was like, pretending to be mad and all that stuff.
Right.
I'm sure he probably was a little mad in a way, but it was all joking. Andy's a great guy.
Yeah, I think he took a lot of pride in that 27.
Yeah, he takes a lot of pride in a lot of things. He's one of the best storytellers in the history of the world, let alone golf.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.